Welcome to Peace Watch Middle East, an exploration of peacemakers and peacemaking in the Middle East. Specifically, the Peace Watch Middle East series talks to people on both sides, Palestinians and Israelis. They may be engaged in nonviolent direct action, or in bicultural cooperation, or in the development of civil society. This edition of Peace Watch Middle East goes outside the Kootenays and chips away at some commonly held stereotypes about Palestinians. Not that you have to take ownership for believing in these stereotypes yourself. Maybe you come from a more enlightened background than I did. I believe that the effort to achieve balance and objectivity requires that I take responsibility for my own personal experience and narrative as it relates to the issue. Until just a few years ago, it would not have occurred to me to think that the West Bank might be home to someone who was every bit as serious about nonviolent direct action as Gandhi or Martin Luther King. In fact, until about 3 years ago, I imagined the Palestinian territories to be inhabited by a handful of terrorists chanting fanatic Islamic slogans in the desert with Yasser Arafat. I'll leave you to speculate on your own about how such a diluted and racist set of stereotypes got into my head and how it lasted for as long as it did. What happened 3 years ago? Quite a lot. It's too complex a story to cover in a single hour, but basically, I started doing some research on my own. There's not a handful of Palestinians in the desert. There are over 3 million Palestinians. Most of them are Muslims. But there is also a lively secular society, people who are not affiliated with any religion at all. If you look at your map, you'll see that Israel and the occupied territories, the whole land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, is slightly taller and a bit narrower than Vancouver Island. In the West Bank, an area slightly larger than some tree farm licenses, I found 9 post-secondary schools, universities, technical and trade schools, 9. That's not counting an even larger number of Israeli universities and the like. These were all Palestinians. I found more that I didn't expect. World-class painters who had grown up in refugee camps. Poets, including one I think compares favorably with the great Spanish poet Federico Garcia Lorca, a man by the name of Marwan Darwish. A theater company doing plays on feminist themes. I certainly didn't expect that, but there it was. Musicians, dancers, and so on. This was in the days before the Oslo process collapsed in failure at Camp David during the latter days of the Clinton administration. There was a lively, articulate, diverse group of people building a modern cultural community on a traditional foundation. I hadn't expected any of this. Ironically, it seemed that Palestinian culture had many of the features that I have always admired about Israeli culture. There is also a small Christian community, not Western Crusaders, but Arab Christians, people whose ancestors were among the first followers of Christ. It was here, among these people, that I found a well-educated, dedicated group of Palestinian activists practicing and teaching the principles of nonviolence. Sami Awad is the executive director of the Holy Land Trust in Bethlehem. I did this telephone interview with him while he was in Los Angeles on a speaking tour of the United States. Just in case you're wondering, in the background, you can hear renovations for the Nelson Fine Arts Center upstairs from the KCR Studio A.
Well, my name is Sami Awad, and I'm a Palestinian Christian from Bethlehem. I grew up all my life in Bethlehem until I had to come to the United States in order to finish my education in college and university after the Israeli army in 1987-88 shut down all educational institutes in the occupied West Bank due to the uprising, the Intifada, which took place at that time.
So that was during the first Intifada, is that right?
Exactly, during the first Intifada.
Okay.
I have a BA degree in political science from the University of Kansas. and I have a master's degree in international relations from the American University in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
I then returned back to Palestine when I finished my education. I was here for about 8 years in the United States. Returned to Palestine and have been working for the Palestinian people, specifically in the Bethlehem area. I'm currently married, and me and my wife have a 3-month-old baby girl.
Oh, really? A baby girl born during the Second Intifada?
A baby girl during the Second Intifada was born during the April incursion into Bethlehem, where, if you remember, we lived under the siege of the Church of Nativity during that time under curfews.
I do remember that quite well. Mm-hmm. That must have been quite an adventure, having a baby during that time.
It was something very difficult for us because we knew Rana was about to have the baby at any time now, and the army was planning to coming into Bethlehem. So what we actually did was we actually had to escape from Bethlehem to Jerusalem, taking very bad and rough dirt roads in order to get to Jerusalem. We consider ourselves very lucky to be able to have that opportunity and friends who were able to help us escape from Bethlehem. And we had the baby in Jerusalem, and a week later returned with the army still present, but returned to our home, because if we were not in our home, then our home itself would be in danger of being attacked and possibly destroyed by the Israeli army.
Were you in danger while you were in Jerusalem?
In Jerusalem, we were not in danger. We were in the Palestinian area in East Jerusalem. We stayed at an uncle's house over there. We did not move much from there because we didn't have the proper papers and documents to be able to move in Jerusalem. So it was at the house, to the hospital, and back to the house where we stayed until we came into Bethlehem.
And you didn't need the papers in order to be in the hospital?
No, it was a Palestinian hospital, private hospital. So there was no coverage as far as insurance, so we had to cover that cost. But that was a small price to pay for having a healthy baby and the wife. And the sad situation is that when Rana had our child, 2 hours later we got a call from friends in Bethlehem, and they were informing us of a sad story about a Palestinian woman in Bethlehem who lost her child because she was not able to get to the hospital. And between her car where she was and the hospital, which was 50 meters away from them, there was an Israeli army tank that had blocked the road and had refused for them to enter, even when her family said, "We'll just carry her, you know, no need to take the car." The army had refused for her to move from that spot. And so she lost her child. The child was born dead there. So it was very emotional for us as we were celebrating the birth of our girl. This family was mourning the death of their baby, and it could have easily been something that we would have experienced as well if we stayed in Bethlehem.
Yeah, right. Unfortunately, those stories are not uncommon. That's not an unusual story, as I understand it. What's the baby's name? What's your daughter's name?
The girl's name is Layar.
Layar.
L-A-Y-A-R.
Nice name.
Thank you.
So you're back in Bethlehem after a period of education in the United States, and is it correct then to say that you formed the Holy Land Trust, or that the Holy Land Trust was formed after you got back? I understand it was set up in 1998.
Yeah, Holy Land Trust was actually initiated by a very big program called the Journey of the Magi. The Journey of the Magi was an idea that had been in development for several years prior to the year 2000. The idea was to celebrate the birth of Jesus in his 2000th birthday with a reenactment of the Journey of the Magi. And what actually happened was a number of people from different parts of the world participated in this journey, which we call the Journey for Peace. And they actually traveled for 99 days in the desert from Iraq, crossing the Syrian desert into Jordan and then to Palestine on walking and on camels. No vehicles were used. Retracing the steps of the Magi, introducing themselves to the peoples of the land, praying with the people of the land, praying for peace of the Middle East, and then arriving in Bethlehem on Christmas Day the year 2000. Holy Land Trust was formed with the journey of the Magi, as both of them developed, the organization was also developed in 1998.
So that was your launching event, was the journey of the Magi?
Yes. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Who are the people who participated in that journey? You describe yourself as a Palestinian Christian, and I have to say that it seems strange to me to ask you questions about that, except that you've brought it up. If I were talking to somebody that I'd never met before in my own hometown, I would never ask to know about their religion or their ethnic background unless they introduced the subject. But I find that in talking to people about the Middle Eastern issue, that it's front and center. It's the first thing that that people talk about. So I wonder, I wonder what type of Christians? Was it primarily Christians who went on this journey? And if so, what types of Christians? Were they indigenous Christians? Were they Christians from around the world, or what?
Yeah, the participants of the Journey of the Magi were Christians, and Christians from all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
We had four of the five continents represented. So we had people from Asia, Africa, Europe, and the Americas represented in this Journey of the Magi. The core group of the journey was 16 individuals. Those are the ones who actually did the entire journey from south of Baghdad all the way to Bethlehem. But throughout the journey, hundreds of people would join them for a one-day or a two-day a trip with them, walking and participating in their activities. Christians and Muslims from these countries welcomed them in their homes and asked them to pray for their peace and for their families. So it was a combination of religions and cultures that participated in this journey.
I see. So there were Muslims who were involved in it too, in a sense.
Yes, Muslims were involved in a lot of the preparation work. You know, we had to get approval from governments, so the Iraqi government, the Syrian government, we had the Jordanians, we had to get the blessings from these governments in order for the Magi to walk in their land and in their country. The Magi met with many Muslim leaders of the Middle East and introduced them to Westerners and foreigners who really cared for the situation of people in the Middle East, who saw the humanity of people living there, not just the big headlines of the news, what people think of people in Iraq and people of Palestine and so on. So it was very wonderful for both people to interact and see that there are people on the other side that really care and have concern about their well-being and their future.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like quite an exciting project. You sound like somebody who thinks that peace is possible in the Middle East.
I do believe so, and it has to be. Peace is the only way for survival. For everybody to survive in the Middle East, we need peace. So it's a must on us, and it's a lot of work. It's not easy to reach peace, but we need it, and I'm very optimistic that through the work we're doing, as well as many other organizations that are working on peace and justice, we will be able to reach peace in that region.
Well, let's talk about that in some more detail. What kind of role does the Holy Land Trust play in the peace movement in Palestine?
Holy Land Trust is one of several organizations that are promoting and teaching and developing with the Palestinian community new approaches to resisting the occupation, what we call nonviolence resistance to the Israeli occupation.
Mm-hmm.
We believe nonviolence is a very powerful weapon when used by the people. The Palestinians have a history of using nonviolence during the First Intifada in 1987. According to certain reports, between 85 and 90% of all activities conducted by Palestinians were nonviolent in nature. The Palestinian nonviolent movement can even be traced back to 1936 during the mass demonstrations that took place at that time.
Could you just pause there for a moment and give us a couple examples? Because that's, let me tell you something. You're talking about events that people here, I think, know next to nothing about, or maybe even absolutely nothing about. Those kinds of events don't break the surface of our media, and it would be really ground-shaking to hear some information about them.
Mm-hmm.
How about 1937? Tell what happened in 1937.
1936, yeah.
36.
In 1936, the Palestinian population participated and led a mass protest movement in Palestine, calling for the British, who had the mandate over Palestine at that time, to grant the Palestinians the right to build a state and have a state under that land and mandate. And
where
they
did this happen?
Did in many activities such as economic boycotts, demonstrations on the streets, many activities of protest and so on in the streets of many cities in Palestine, demanding that they have to the right to establish a state in that area.
So this was all over Palestine?
All over Palestine in 1936.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1987, during the first uprising against the Israeli occupation, again, all of the Palestinian population involved participated in many, many activities, such as, again, economic boycotts of the Israeli products, refusing to pay taxes to the Israeli military authority, closing of shops when the Israeli army was forcing people to open shops, and vice versa, refusing to go to work in Israeli factories and businesses. So many people who used to work in Israel during that time boycotted that completely. Palestinians who were involved in working with Israeli police forces just in basic civil duty also pulled themselves out of that function and boycotted that completely. It created a lot of pressure on the Israeli government, and it created a lot of awareness internationally about the reality of the occupation and the situation that Palestinians are living under.
It sounds as though there is some basis in the population and in the belief of the people for a significant non-violent movement. Is that fair to say? I am asking you yes or no questions.
Yeah. We believe, as I said, historically the Palestinians have used non-violence, so we're not bringing new methods and new approaches to them, or what are sometimes referred to as Western approaches of resistance and so on. We feel that this is part of the Palestinian culture. The Palestinian culture has not been violent in nature. I mean, we've never had an established army. We never had military bases. We never had the schools that taught, war and the fighting and so on. So we believe that this is part of the Palestinian nature that can be used and needs to be brought out again by the Palestinians in their continuous resistance movements.
Some of these actions that you describe sound like job actions on the part of a union. Is there a union movement in Palestine?
During the first uprising, many of the activities were led by unions. At this time, the current conflict, it's very difficult for people to engage in such things. So we need a mass population. We need new organizations and new networks to be developed that will lead directly with all the population of the community, not just with unions.
Uh-huh. Well, speaking of all of the population of the community, is there, you've spoken about cooperative projects with Muslims in connection with the Journey of the Magi. Are there cooperative projects with the Jewish population?
Well, for the nonviolence resistance movement, we believe that there's a lot of work that needs to be done as well in the Israeli community, promoting peace and justice for Palestinians and Israelis. So we continuously encourage the peace movement in Israel to reemerge and to grow again and not to sit still and allow the continuous destruction to take place against the Palestinians. The current situation of Palestinians is that we are under continuous curfew now, living under a 24-hour house arrest for as many days as the Israeli military decides that we should remain under curfew. So, for example, in Bethlehem, we cannot leave our homes completely and absolutely until we are given 2-3 hours every 6 or 7 days for us to go buy basic food items and medicines, and then we have to be home before the curfew is reimposed again. What that's creating is a lot of pressure, a lot of frustration in the Palestinian community, which many of them are seeing violence as the only option to get out of that pressure. And at the same time, we're not seeing a movement in the Israeli community that is saying, you know, what our government is doing is actually not providing us security, it's not providing us peace, it's not leading to a process that will achieve peace, but it's actually creating more violence and more anger, and we need to stand up and say stop to that.
Uh-huh. Are you aware of the refuseniks in Israel?
Yes, and we are actually in contact with a few of them. The refuseniks are those people who have decided that they will refuse to serve in the Israeli military in the occupied territories. What's very interesting about those who are involved in this is that they are not composed mainly of young individuals who are afraid to go and serve or who don't want to serve, but they are actually composed of individuals who are highly ranked within the Israeli military establishment and have actually served in the occupied territories and have come to the logical conclusion that everything that we had done to the Palestinians up until this point has not provided us with the security. In addition to that, it is morally unjustified the way we treat the majority of the Palestinians by mass punishing an entire population for the acts of a few individuals.
I wonder if do you know of any other organizations or any other smaller groups of people in Israel that take a similar position or that are supportive of them?
Yeah, there are several organizations. One is called Gush Shalom. There is Rabbis for Human Rights. One very active organization is the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolition, mm-hmm. which fights for the rights of Palestinians' homes not to be destroyed as settlements continue to expand into Palestinian areas and territories and more land is being confiscated. It's not always land with no houses that are taken over for settlement expansions. Many times homes exist on these lands, and these homes are being demolished and destroyed for the purpose of settlement expansion. So this group, it's an Israeli group, and it's very, very active in raising these issues within the Israeli and the international communities.
Uh-huh. Does the Holy Land Trust have an opportunity to work with groups like the Committee Against Home Destruction and Gush Shalom, or is that something that just can't happen because of the nature of the occupation?
Well, the first problem, as you said, it's the nature of the occupation. At this time, we cannot even leave our homes, mm-hmm. Not alone conduct any activities, either Palestinian-only or Palestinian-Israeli activities. But what we believe is that they have a lot of work to do in their own community. It's a very tough battle within the Israeli community to wake Israelis up and tell them what we are doing is wrong, not just for the Palestinians, but also for Israelis themselves. And we have a lot of work to do in our community as well in the fighting of the occupation. So we encourage each other, we are in communication, but we continue to tell them, the battlefield is very big, you have your own battles you have to wage, and we have our own battles we have to wage. And eventually, as we develop a stronger movement in Palestine, then we will start doing more and more activities jointly.
The whole thing of curfews and the intensification of the occupation raises a question for me. Back in May of this year, two of your board members, Jonathan Kutab and Mubarak Awad, called for elections and for the formation of a social democratic party to provide, I'm quoting here, to provide a political home for those who are dissatisfied with the current factions, unquote. Since that time, President Arafat has called an election for January 2003, and President Bush has called for actually quite a number of things, including getting rid of President Arafat and a constitution for Palestine and a balanced budget and a number of things that he doesn't seem to be able to do even in his own country. What I wonder is whether or not you think that this election will take place. Do you think that's that given the nature of the occupation and the curfews and that sort of thing, is it possible to have an election under those conditions?
Well, we do hope that the elections will take place. But in order for the elections to take place, we need the freedom to be able to move within our communities, to be able to talk and teach people about their responsibilities in a democracy. We don't do elections for the sake of electing or going to the polls. People need to understand their responsibilities and what's demanded of them in a democracy to participate in an election process. I can say that if the situation continues as it is now, we aren't going to have elections. If the occupation, incursions, and curfew remain, we are not going to have elections. It will be pointless, for example, to have elections in a curfew because we just can't even go to the polls and vote. And Palestinians will refuse, again, to have it open for 2 hours for them to go out of their homes to go to the polls and then have to return to their homes. That's not a democracy. That doesn't create the environment and atmosphere of debate and democracy and how a society should be built. Many people will vote, if under this current pressure, they will vote simply out of frustration, not because of what political parties might have as a vision for the future, for the Palestinian people, or even a vision for peace with Israel. That's one of the problems with the statements made by George Bush, for example. I mean, when he said, you know, you have to get rid of your leader, many Palestinians will vote now for President Arafat, re-elect him, not because of his vision for the future, but simply as a protest vote against American intervention. And, you know, that creates, that moves the whole democratic process off track, as they say, when people start participating in this thing. And this can happen not just in Palestine, anywhere in the world, where another powerful country, which has been perceived and is perceived for many years as the ally of your enemy, is telling you who to vote for and not to vote for. People are going to vote for the person that they tell us not to vote for, simply as giving them a message on this issue.
You're listening to Peace Watch Middle East, and I'm talking to Sami Awad, the executive director of the Holy Land Trust in Bethlehem. We're coming up on the half hour here, and this is Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY-FM, 93.5 in Nelson, B.C. Don't forget to get your name on our participant list for the second half of this series. Write or call KCR with the name of one Jewish Israeli and one Palestinian whom you respect. Get your paper and pencil ready, and I'll give you that address and phone number toward the end of the show. Remember to give us your name, too, and remember that respect is the key word.
How do you see the future of Palestine?
Well, as nonviolent activists promoting nonviolence resistance, we have the same aims and aspirations as the majority of the Palestinian people. So we have the same goals, but there are different paths that have been set by different people as to how to get to those goals. Through nonviolence, we believe that we can achieve the aspirations of the Palestinians, which are the establishment of an independent, democratic Palestinian state in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, the dismantling of all of the settlements in the occupied territories and the settlers' return to their homes in Israel, a serious discussion and a resolution of the Palestinian refugee issue. There are millions of Palestinian refugees living in refugee camps all over the Middle East. To us, they have suffered the most and are paying the greatest sacrifice for what happened in 1948 and 67, and a serious resolution to their issue has to take place. And the final aim and goal of the Palestinians is that East Jerusalem becomes the capital of the Palestinian state as West Jerusalem becomes the capital of the Israeli state. So these are the goals that we see, and we believe that through nonviolence, we don't just achieve these goals, but we are also able to achieve peace between peoples as well, peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. We are not seeking a political peace similar to the one that is between Jordan and Israel or Egypt and Israel, where it's a peace between politicians, but the people have absolutely no interaction and no care for each other. That will not work for us. We're not seeking countries with borders. We're seeking societies that are open to each other. Each has its own governing structure, but at the same time, there is this respect and understanding and cooperation between the people for both peoples to grow.
So you're not talking about a single state solution, although it sounds, as when you talk about open borders, it sounds almost like that.
Well, a single state solution is not something that is dismissed by the Palestinians, but if the Israeli society continues to be founded on the principles which they set for themselves, the principles of Zionism, which is a Jewish state for the Jewish people where the majority will be Jewish in that state, then it will be difficult to include Palestinians in that state, Palestinians who are Christian and Muslim. So demographically, what will happen in this one state is that the majority of the population at one point will be Christian and Muslim. The majority, of course, will be Muslim even in this one state. It's a hope and it's a dream, and hopefully it will be a reality one day where, you know, countries are not based and formed on religion and ideology, but are based on respect for others, a secular governing system where everyone has his own religion and ability to pray in their holy sites with absolute freedom. But that's going to take a lot of activities within the Israeli community to move out of Zionism and into developing a secular nation state.
Okay, well, while you bring up the question of Zionism, one of the things that we hear about here a lot these days, lately especially, is the active financial support for the occupation from American right-wing fundamentalist Christian Zionists. What is the relationship of the Holy Land Trust to groups like that?
Well, we don't have a good relationship, sadly. But we believe that they are not on the right track. Even in their support for Israel, we believe that if they want to support Israel, they have the right to do so. That's their choice. I don't believe in the religious reasonings they are using to justify their support for Israel. Within the Christian community, of course, there are different interpretations of prophecy, of the Bible. When prophecy happened, does prophecy continue forever? When the land was given to them the first time and it was a response to prophecy and they disobeyed God during that time and they were removed from that land, does the same prophecy still continue forever and ever? So there is this big debate within the Christian community. Fundamentalist Christians believe that this is God's will, that Israel be there. As Christians, my message to them is your work in life being here on earth is to promote peace, justice, and love as well between the peoples of the world. You are to love your enemy no matter who they are. You are not to support blindly Israeli atrocities and actions against another group of people, no matter what that group of people is. We are working very hard. Christians in the United States, many of them, are actually becoming more aware of the reality of the situation there, of the injustice that is taking place. In my current tour in the United States, I've met with many Christians who refer to themselves as right-wing Christians, and many of them are interested in finding out what the situation is there like, what the real story is there like. So we continue encouraging them, you know. You want to support Israel? Support Israel. But for Israel's survival and for Israel remaining to exist the way you want it to exist, Israel needs peace with the Palestinians. It needs peace with the rest of its neighbors as well. And this way you could continue supporting Israel and not leading to the destruction of Israel as you blindly support it.
Uh-huh. I'd like to go back to the question of the refugees for a moment, because that's always seemed to me to be a central human issue. It's not symbolic to me at all. Are Palestinian Christians part of that refugee population? Are they part of the are there Palestinian Christians who would return to some place within the Green Line if they were allowed to do that?
Yeah. Palestinian Christians are part of the refugees. Some Palestinian Christians are part of the Palestinian refugee population. My family, my father's family, is actually refugee as well. They used to live in what is now West Jerusalem, which is the Israeli side of Jerusalem. And in 1948, they were kicked out of their home by the Israeli army. When they found out that they were Palestinian, they were kicked out of West Jerusalem and became refugees and moved into Bethlehem. So we have that history of being a refugee family as well on our own. The question is, when it comes to resolving this issue, many Palestinian refugees believe that it is their right, it is their moral right, and it is their right under international law to return to the homes that they were kicked out of in 1948. The question is, then, how do we resolve this issue? If they are returned to what is now Israel, that again affects the demography of the country, and Israel will clearly refuse to allow for that to happen. The majority will eventually become Muslims or Christian or a Palestinian, we could say. So a serious discussion needs to take place in resolving the refugee issue. The refugees are suffering the most. They have not been accepted by the Arab countries where they are living now to become citizens of those countries, because they are not wanted by these Arab countries as well. So many of them don't even have documents to prove who they are, other than the documents that they took with them when they left, like the refugees who live in Lebanon, other than United Nations cards that are granted to them. They suffer the most, they are under the most pain, and their problem has to be seriously resolved in order for there to be peace in the Middle East.
Okay.
You want options, or?
Well, options is an interesting way to put it. I'd like to hear something in terms of just a concrete sort of thing. All I've read, to tell you the truth, is discussions about percentages or mass numbers, like, well, we'll let 20,000 go back over a period of time, something like that. And that seems to me to leave out of account the intensely individual nature of some of that suffering and of all of those people. So what do you see as a possible step after serious discussion? What would be a plausible way to start resolving that problem?
Well, I think the most important issue in resolving the Palestinian refugee problem deals with the moral recognition that this problem exists. And I believe many Palestinians, refugees as well, simply are seeking for the Israeli government to recognize that there is a problem, and the Israeli government was involved in the creating of this problem, and this problem needs to be resolved and dealt with. So I think a moral recognition of this problem is a very important first step that needs to be taken. In terms of resolutions to the refugee problem, as we said earlier, in terms of percentages and number of people returning, it's going to be impossible for Israel, which has built itself as a Jewish nation where the majority continuously forever have to be of Jewish origin, will allow for Palestinians to come and live in their cities, even as Israeli citizens. So there are talks about certain numbers that may be allowed to return back, but that number does not exceed 100,000 in the millions of refugees that exist around the Middle East. Certain actions need to take place with these individuals and families, such as resettling them in different countries around the Middle East and the world. I don't know if it's true or not, but I read reports that maybe even like the Canadian government or the Australian government might be opened to take some families of these refugees and settle them in their countries. Arab countries might have to also be involved in dealing with this issue and taking some refugees and settling them there. And then we have to also recognize of the right of them to return to Palestine, to the West Bank and Gaza, if not to what is now Israel. So that option also has to be open for Palestinians to be able to take in. Now, again, they might not be able to take everybody in just because of the pressures economically and population-wise that will create on the Palestinians. So, for example, Gaza is the most highly populated piece of land in the world now. They will not be able to take more refugees. They will actually have to send refugees out to other areas of Palestine when there is a resolution to the situation. And then there are the issues of compensating for the Palestinian refugees through monetary issues. I don't know what a price is to give to a family that has for 50 years been waiting to return to their home, have sacrificed so much time and effort, their land was stolen from them, and so on. But, I mean, these issues have been dealt with previously in history, and they can be an option to be dealt with for the future as well.
Okay. I'd like to move on to the relation of the international community to this question. We've touched a bit on George Bush's announcement, I guess, his statement about the Middle East. And it seems to me that the United States is unique in its relation to the Middle East. I wonder if you have thoughts about what kind of relationship, if any, the United States should, or what kind of part the United States should play in bringing peace to the Middle East.
Yeah, well, we believe that the United States should continue to play a major part in resolving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and in bringing peace to the Middle East. The problem with this part so far, it has been very biased towards Israel, while demanding many things from the Palestinian Authority to take actions to provide security for Israel. It has not done anything demanding of Israel to provide a sense of hope for the Palestinians, where they are able to tell the Palestinians there is a process happening, and we need to stop and even be able to force the extreme groups from conducting their violent activities because there is a sense of hope for the future. The U.S. Is the only power in the world at this time. The Europeans, even though they are very fair-handed in the criticism of both Palestinians and Israelis and in promoting peace between the Palestinians and Israelis have not been able to create the necessary pressure on Israel. Israel simply does not listen to demands made by the Europeans, the United Nations as well. Even when a resolution is passed in the United Nations and the U.S. does not veto it, such as an investigation of what happened in the Jenin refugee camp in the month of April, Israel said no, simply. Said no to that investigative committee, and they were not allowed to come in to conduct a United Nations passed resolution where everybody supported that act. So the U.S. has to be involved, but what we are seeking is a more fair-handed involvement. As you create pressure on the Palestinians, create also pressures on the Israelis. As you support one, support the other to move towards peace and justice. And I believe it's the U.S. that can actually have that leverage with Israel.
Stop me if you disagree. I'm just going to try to paraphrase what I at least part of what I think you just said. It seems to me that you're saying that the problem with the United States playing the role of the mediator is that they are not unbiased, and the mediator has to be unbiased. And the problem with Europe or the UN playing the role of the mediator is that while they are less biased or possibly not biased, they don't have the clout to influence the Israelis in particular. That sounds like an impasse to me, but you believe that the United States can simply mend its ways and become unbiased? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Well, that's what we're hoping. And I believe that the people living in the United States, Americans, are starting to realize that there is something wrong happening there, that whatever is happening in the Middle East has affected us tremendously, as we know from the terror attacks that took place on September 11th. So people want to know what's happening, and I believe that there is a movement amongst American citizens to start learning and become involved in a process where they see, okay, it's time to take serious steps to resolving this and ending this. I believe that the American government, as I said earlier, needs to start realizing that for the sake of Israel, they have to push Israel sometimes to make these tough decisions and steps for the sake of peace and for the sake of Israel to remain existent in the Middle East. And that can only be through peace with its neighbors. A million Israelis have actually left Israel in the last 2 years, not left for good, but have left for temporary periods of time because it's very tough to live there. Economically, they're also suffering. Tourism has gone down, affecting both Palestinians and Israelis. So it's a very, very tough situation now for everybody living there. And if the U.S. wants to support Israel, then they need to support a peace between Israel and its neighbors.
Okay. I'd like to move on to another question. And this is really based on a quotation from that article that I quoted earlier by Jonathan Katab and Mubarak Awad, where they say, I think this is an unusual position for a nonviolent movement, and so I'd like to get you to enlarge on it, if you would. They say, although Palestinian armed struggle against the occupation is both morally and legally legitimate, it may be ineffective, futile, and counterproductive. If Palestinians choose nonviolence, it would only be because they are convinced that it can achieve results. It must be engaged in as a serious, militant, and difficult choice in favor of resistance and struggle. Submission to occupation and surrender is not an option for us. I think the part that people would find surprising and possibly disagreeable is that very first that very, very first clause, that Palestinian armed struggle against the occupation is both morally and legally legitimate. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, well, the point that is made from that statement is that the Palestinians have the legitimate right to resist. Now, if the Palestinians had F-16 fighter jets, tanks, Apache helicopters, and high-caliber machine guns, and they were resisting the occupation through these recognized war methods around the world, then the world will say, oh, yes, this is a legitimate tool that can be used by the Palestinians or any group in the resistance of an occupation. So this is the point that is made through this statement. If we had the same weapons that the Israelis are using against us, then we would be morally, according to the international community, justified in our resistance movement. What the Palestinians lack are these weapons, and thank God they lack these weapons. I believe they don't help in any way or form, but they have other forms of using violence, such as creating homemade bombs, strapping them around their bodies, and committing suicide attacks. These are not morally justified, even in this article. The aim was to say that, you know, if we have weapons, you will not be against us. You might be even supportive of us, as you would call us freedom fighters or part of a guerrilla warfare or whatever justification you would give to using of these weapons. But we are not justified in using these other forms because they are the only forms that we have. So the nonviolent movement actually comes from the fact that resistance has to continue. We are not saying in nonviolence, calling for, you know, passive demonstrations and, you know, actions where, you know, we sort of, you know, if we are nice to them and we stop the resistance and stop our activities, then maybe they'll be nice in return and give us something in return. We want to engage the Palestinian population in a resistance movement, in a action-oriented, nonviolent movement that takes a lot of courage, it takes a lot of dedication, takes a lot of sacrifice, because many Palestinians can and probably will lose their lives in a nonviolent movement as well. But that's the aim of this movement.
So you said earlier that a lot of work needed to be done on both sides, and you've said somewhere that a lot of work needs to be done to convince more Palestinians to participate in nonviolent means for resisting the occupation. What do you have in mind? What kinds of things need to be done, and what is the Holy Land Trust doing?
Well, the most important thing is that there are many misperceptions of nonviolence. Some of them, as I said earlier, being a passive movement. This is what Palestinians think of nonviolence as well. It's a passive movement, non-confrontational activities, and so on. So these are the misperceptions that we have to change, and that is done through education, through providing examples from different parts of the world, such as the liberation movement in India under Gandhi, or the civil rights movement in the United States under Martin Luther King. Some of these examples, and different examples, such as the collapse of communism in many Eastern European countries, which was done through nonviolence. So we show these examples to them, we educate them, we try to explain to them about the power of nonviolence. As I said earlier, we set the same goals that they have been aspiring for. So we cannot, as nonviolent activists, say, well, you know, you might get less, we might have to compromise here and there. No, we have these goals that we believe are achievable and can be achieved, but the way to achieve them best is through nonviolence. So that's what we're pushing and promoting. It has been difficult since the current uprising broke out. We have been trying for over a year and a half to talk to many people about nonviolence, and many times not many people listen. But what we have seen recently is a movement within the Palestinian community to become aware of nonviolence, to the point where in Bethlehem we had a group of young men involved in armed resistance, the young men who actually use arms against the occupation and fighting the Israeli incursions into our cities. They came to us 2 months ago and said, we're tired of the violence, we're tired of the destruction and death, but we want to continue resistance. We do not want to give up. So if you have anything to show us, show us. And we sat with them, we talked with them, we convinced them, and we have actually started doing training programs with these individuals in the Bethlehem area, teaching them nonviolent means of resisting the occupation.
That's very encouraging news. I'd like to leave you with the last word. Is there anything that you'd like to say, anything that we haven't talked about that you would like to make sure that our listeners know?
Well, I think that people need to realize is that the conflict of the Middle East is not confined to the borders of the countries in the Middle East. It's not confined to the area between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. The conflict of in the Middle East affects every single one of us around the world in one way or the other. That's why I call for people to become more involved, more educated about the situation in the Middle East, and also to become active participants in pushing their countries and their governments to force and work hard with both communities, the Palestinians and the Israelis community, to achieve peace between the peoples of that region, a peace that is not just founded on security, but is founded on providing justice for all those who live in that part of the world.
Sami Awad, it's been a pleasure talking to you today, and I wish you luck with your nonviolent movement.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
This is Peace Watch Middle East, and I'm Jim Terrell. You've been listening to an interview with Sami Awad, the executive director of the Holy Land Trust in Bethlehem. Don't forget to get your name on our participants list for the second half of the series. Write or call KCR with the name of one Jewish Israeli and one Palestinian whom you respect. The phone number for Co-op Radio is 352-9600. An alternate number, or you can also send a fax to 352-9653. For general inquiries and for the purposes of this participants list, you can send an email to KCR at Kootenai Co-op Radio, that's all one word, kootenaicoopradio.com, or you can write to Box 767, Nelson, B.C., V1L5R4. This show was first broadcast on September the 27th and will be rebroadcast a week later. A new edition of Peace Watch Middle East will come your way on October the 11th, Friday at 1. See you then. Thanks for listening.